When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone. Just two quick things before starting possibly the most singularly bookish episode I think I've ever done. Firstly, Rose had a greyhound, which made a little bit of noise. So hopefully those noise issues aren't a problem for anyone. And secondly, due to the choice of books, I'm going to have to put in a quick trigger warning. We do talk around the issue of sexual violence just a little bit. So just wanted to put that warning in there as well. Anyways, that's enough from me. Enjoy the show.
Sandspants Radio, Australia's most procedurally generated podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorales. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show we have comedian and writer Rose Bishop. How you doing, Rose?
Yeah, I'm all right, you know, considering.
Considering?
Lockdown six, we're in it. We're sitting in it.
Yeah. Look, I see we're gonna timestamp this immediately, this podcast, for exactly where it's at. I feel like we're better off now than we were, like, actually, no, that's a crazy thing to say. I'm totally showing my privilege right now, but a week ago, purely because, like, now we know. Like, yeah. A week ago, it was like there was a chat, like, it was, oh, might be in, might be out, what's going on? But now we're like, oh, no, we're in prison now.
No, I agree, you know, because it's hope is important, but certainty is as well. And we've got certainty now that we'll be in lockdown for longer.
Yeah, fixed forever, basically. Yep. Yeah.
And, it's, you know, done. That's a kind of psychological cold comfort, so sure.
I guess, yeah. Again, showing off that there's no, like, pressing issues concerning me, apart from my, oh, I feel so sad about I can't go to a cafe.
Yeah, but, you know, literally what can you do?
Nothing. Mm. They'll get vaccinated, I guess. That's about the only thing.
Done that.
Yeah?
I'm done. Fully vaxxed.
Ah, okay. Show off. So now you go, AZ or Pfizer?
Got the old Pfizer. So now I'm just I'm just chilling, relaxing, having a great time in jail in my house. No, it's fine. It's fine. The sun's out. Me and my housemate have fostered a greyhound, which may bark at some point during this recording because he's just had foot surgery and he's very antsy because he can't go for a walk.
Wait. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. He literally can't.
Because his foot. Yeah. Well, he can. Yeah. He wants to, but he's got a big fat infected foot in a bandage. So
why would you get a greyhound?
Oh, it's a foster. It's not it's a nice thing. I'm doing a nice thing. I'm a good person.
This is all I hear about greyhounds is that they're a quivering mess of anxiety and stress. Oh, yeah. Now,
this one kind of rules. Like, he's a real little butthole, but he's good. He's really confident and he's like a dog, which is rare for greyhounds.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Nah, this guy's cool. He's a big fat for a greyhound. He's a big chunky chiller called Teddy and he's pretty cool. But, yeah, he's barking a lot at the moment because he's just mad about not being able to go for a walk. And every time a dog walks past, he's like, I'm going to kill you. Your walk showing privileges.
Him. Yeah, yeah.
And you know what? I feel it. Yeah, I feel it, that's Ted. What I was gonna say. None of us enjoy it. Yeah. Yeah, he's in his own little dog lockdown and he's also hating it.
Yeah.
But no, it's something to do. It's nice. It's some structure in the day because you constantly got to be like, has he pooed? Has he peed? Has he pooed? Has he peed? Food, food.
It just sounds like so much effort, but I get it.
It is. It's rewarding, though, when he puts his wet little face on your lap. It's kind of nice. He's a very moist dog. I don't know why. So he's dripping from the nose.
Okay, that does sound pretty adorable, but yeah, still, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a.
He's just a foster. He's just come straight off the racetrack, and we're sort of getting him used to living in a home and not being a weird goblin, and he's getting there.
Okay. Well, that's helpful, yeah. And then it's not too much of a commitment because then he'll move on. Yeah. And you can. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's probably going to get adopted out in the next few weeks.
Oh, okay. Okay, so yeah. Doing that sort of thing. Nice. Cool. Mm-hmm. And that does fill in some of the time. And then you get to read books because I've seen you got a whole bookshelf behind you.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's pretty common. I think I'm like a lot of other people our age in that, like, I sort of picked up a book in, you know, beginning of the first sort of wave of lockdowns and was like, huh, when was the last time I did this? And it's been nice. I mean, I still haven't read all that much because, I don't know, I think it's pretty hard to sort of concentrate at the moment. And I think sometimes at this point in adulthood, you sort of learn to see reading as a chore by accident because you haven't yet entered your mum phase where you love novels again and crime thrillers and like flowery novels about people finding themselves after a divorce and stuff. So like I think there's this bit in the middle where like you love books when you're a kid because, well, I don't know if kids now do, but you know, you love books when you're a kid because that's what you do. You read books. That's your escapism. And then as an adult, you're like, ugh, uni, ugh, homework, ugh, effort, scroll, scroll, scroll. And then you enter your mum years and you get jazzed about it again.
So you got the glorious mum years to look forward to.
Yeah, but right now I'm sort of in that book wasteland where I'm like, ugh, reading, and then you open up a book and you're like, oh, this rules.
Yeah. Okay, so that's because your choice of book made you think like you are deep.
Depressing and pretentious, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's not the kind of book which, so your book of choice for today is?
It's called Disgrace. I don't know if I've ever heard the author's name said out loud. J.M. Coetzee, I assume it's Coetzee.
Yeah.
South African writer. It won the Man Booker Prize, I think, in 1999. I read it for the first time in first year uni in 2004, and then reread it this year for the first time since. Hadn't read it in the meantime, have kept my copy of it the whole time because it was deeply affecting when I first read it, but also kind of couldn't bring myself to revisit it. It's traumatic.
Yeah. Like, as in, I haven't read it. I just did a quick little summary so I could appreciate what it is. And I was like, hoo boy, this is.
Yeah. And look, it probably needs a little bit of a trigger warning that it does, like, deal with, you know, sexual violence quite explicitly. Not something that I'm intending to talk about in any detail, but, you know, for anyone who finds that triggering, it's probably not. It may come up at some point because it's a sort of central aspect of it is like sexual violence. So
yeah,
cool,
yeah.
Cool, no, and fun.
Well, yeah, I guess like from what I'm reading of a summary of it, it's just about a lecturer who has an affair with a student that gets disgraced, and then he goes off and lives with his daughter, and then a bunch of messed up shit happens there. And it's basically he just loses everything in his life, and then I tried to actually skip because it sounds so interesting. I really want to read it, but like there is some small redemption of him losing, finding out who he is a little bit by the end.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what I love about it actually, is there's kind of no redemption. It's sort of about a man unraveling. In a really interesting way. It's not really about, like, it's sort of like the protagonist is deeply unlikable and he doesn't become any more likable by the end of it. And it's sort of it feels like the author kind of grappling a little bit with the sort of post-apartheid situation in South Africa through the character of this deeply privileged man who doesn't really understand his own power and sort of, yeah, sees himself as a victim of the decline of civilization. And he's not so much redeemed in the end as he is sort of like as a lot of his sort of pretensions and privileges and ideas about the world are sort of stripped away, and he's in a much sort of baser state. It's a really short novel. It's a really quick read. It's a really easy read, even though it's fucking disturbing. But it sort of starts with him in his sort of university setting, and by the end of it, he's like scarred and alone and confused and broke, and like his only sort of hobby or daily activity is euthanizing dogs. He's been trying to write an opera, which has been reduced to him just like making up songs on a broken banjo. And it's a bit of a bleak read, but it's very interesting. And it's sort of, yeah, it deals with like colonialism and gendered violence, but not directly and not sort of politically, as silly as that sounds. It's more sort of about lineages of power and about, I mean, for me, I haven't really read much criticism of it because I don't want to because it affected me so much. But it feels to me like it's about like lineages of power and about the like and about how nonsensical the idea of civilization is and about, you know, what people really are at their core, which is power struggling mud grubs.
Okay. Wow. All right. That's
so yeah, it's a chill, fun beach read. Pick it up. You'll have a great time.
That's hilarious. Just like there's a nice variety in these episodes. Sometimes they're very light and relaxed, and other times it's whew, there's
yeah. Look, topics. Honestly, it's just I think it is where my brain's at. I was perusing my bookshelf for something to read, and I looked at that, and I was just feeling very COVID-y, you know, tail end of all these lockdowns, and something was like, I think this is a book that I should reread. And I found it really interesting and really reflective reading it again, because I think when I first read it, early uni, sort of coming into feminist sensibilities, I was really quite focused on the sort of gendered violence aspect of it. And there is some really interesting stuff in there about how, like, women's bodies kind of are often, like, you know, the site of power struggles and of, you're right, we all benefit societal violence. And I was probably more focused on that when I first read it, and then reading it again, I've sort of had a completely different kind of take on it, or picked out different things.
Okay. As take on the novel or take on that topic as
take
well?
On the novel. Yeah, no, I haven't been red pilled. I'm a men's rights activist now, so yeah, okay. So I think it's actually good that there's assaults in it. Yeah. No, it's just like I think this time what stood out for me more, and I think what my brain was like, you will find interesting if you read this again, was more the aspects of the stuff about like civilization and the way we sort of think about ourselves as individuals or as part of a society and power and what the loss of power does to a person. Because I think we're seeing that a lot at the moment in these lockdown protests.
You're doing my work for me. I like it. All right. So you want to connect it to that? No. So you think as in when people feel that their power is getting taken away, they'll react in extreme ways? Is that what you're trying to
say? Like definitely when they feel their power is being taken away, but it's sort of, it helped me to sort of reframe it as like thinking about how maybe part of the problem is that we never really have power. It's just we sort of live in this kind of capitalist culture that convinces us that we are like individuals with all this like power to do what we want and have what we want, and it's actually kind of not true. And that maybe there's like a bunch of these like kooks and loons are actually kind of realizing that at the moment, and they don't like it.
Yeah, as in like we're not. There is no individual, when you're living in a society, because there are interlocking, like...
Yeah, or it's just not... It's just not,
and you don't have that much power. No individual has power without it involving other people, so yeah.
Yeah, and also that, like, maybe your individualism isn't actually necessarily as important as you thought it was, or, like, maybe it's less important in moment, because we are living through, like, you know, a pretty major historical event, and if there's one thing that historical events tend to do, it is, like, eclipse the identity of individuals and sort of show us like it's sort of like lay bare fault lines of power and stuff like that. And I think
So you're saying just the sheer magnitude of what's going on its own like kind of making people be like, it's putting you in your place.
A little bit, but also I think it I think it's really interesting. Like, if there's one good thing that's come out of the pandemic, definitely in Australia, and I assume probably in similar countries, it's that people have sort of, like, it's laid bare a lot of economic inequality. Like, it's made people realize that, like, you know, because I think we have a tendency as sort of middle-class people, I guess maybe now I'm technically middle-class, like, to sort of assume that we're pretty secure and comfortable, and then stuff like this makes you realize that, you know, unless you're pretty privileged, like you're actually not that many paychecks away from disaster when something like this happens. And so a bunch of people like having their ability to work taken away, or like small businesses having their ability to earn money taken away, makes you realize like, oh, I'm actually like a little bit powerless in the face of, you know, economic structures that don't really have my best interests at heart.
I love how this could take a turn into a anti-capitalist podcast at any second.
I'm never more than about 45 seconds away for an anti-capitalist rant. They're always bubbling under the surface.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, it's not wrong. you're not wrong. You know, it's people can, and that's part of, I think, the what you're saying about the individual thing, because like they consider themselves individual from an economic sense, and then they quickly find out how flimsy that situation is.
Well, I think capitalism has a vested interest in us seeing ourselves as individual actors, because, you know, the like one of the bigger threats to like unfettered capitalism would be things like trade union movements or you know, massive social, like, welfare safety nets that mean that people can't be exploited as easily for their labor because they can be more choosy about what jobs they take on and stuff. And so, yeah, I think it would be cool if one thing that came out of this was a little bit more sort of class consciousness and understanding that we all have an interest in changing things, not just the poorest amongst us.
Yeah, it benefits everyone. I think that's part of the I was chatting to someone recently about that. It's one of the mistakes of the left, if you want to call it that, in general, is that they frame things in terms of we're trying to help people out, when actually forget that. Don't let the right claim selfishness. No, you're being selfish for helping other people out, because it makes your life better as well, because the society actually runs more efficiently. So throw out all of that huggins and stuff. No, it's actually better for society when it's got a bigger social welfare net.
Yes, like that's
for you to
true.
Go to work and have a job and be comfortable.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's really unhelpful to frame it as almost charity. Like we should organize on the left to help those poor people. It's like you're right. We all
forget other people. I don't give a shit about them. I want to be better off. Which means you need to look after everyone purely because it makes society better for me, on a selfish perspective.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
But yeah, I think
dogs.
Like,
it still makes sense.
But like, yeah, thinking about that stuff and reflecting after rereading this has been kind of helpful, because I think I was sort of locked in a bit of like just perpetual like doom scrolling and outrage over all like the lockdown protests and all, also, you know, just like this insane conspiracy theorism that's going around, and it feels like sort of the maybe the less like people just seem to be falling like dominoes to it as things get harder and harder. And yeah, I think there's sort of a tendency to just sort of assume that things make sense, or that people are doing things for motives that are kind of rational, but that they've just come to the wrong conclusion. And it was kind of helpful to me to sort of like, yeah, just to reframe it as more sort of like howling into the void. And that this is, that sometimes these protests and these frankly insane ideas are more of a an expression of people's distress more than any like rationally held belief. Helped me have a little more compassion.
yeah, that's like, I love the idea of you trying to get off doom scrolling by reading a book that's this depressing as well.
Yeah. No, it helped. Honestly helped.
It's not what you would think, but like, I could kind of see that. You're like, okay, getting a bit of perspective. And also probably when you're caught up in any historical time, like you said, it helps to read about other historical times and be like, okay, yes, this one is pretty major, but there have been other ones in there. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I don't really like the sort of almost like meme that's going around of like, well, imagine if you're in Afghanistan, because I don't know, I find that really othering to just, yeah, it's a little bit like your mum being like, eat everything on your plate, there's children starving in Africa kind of stuff. I don't love that.
You don't want to be one of them.
Yeah, it still feels kind of colonial and us and them, and yeah, I don't like that exactly, but yeah, it is nice to reframe my thinking a little bit. And yeah,
I think as long as you're aware of the risk of that otherness, I think it's very appropriate, actually, just because like it's perspective. As long as you don't treat it like, ha ha ha, yeah, I'm not one of them, but like as long as you're like, oh no, it is important to have gratitude for the lucky things, whilst also being happy for them to change and improve.
Yes, and I do have gratitude. I've had such an easy pandemic compared to other people. I've had housemates through it, so I've had a little bit of company. I've had a job that I can do from home. Like, it's definitely not been as bad as it could be. As much as it's really hard to work full time during a pandemic, it is also just something to do.
I love that reason. It's like, yeah, it's paycheck, but it's also something to do. It's nice.
There's just so much time to fill.
Crazy. Yeah. You got books to read. Yeah. Maybe you need something a bit longer than disgrace.
does make you realize how insane full-time work though is, though, when you've got like nothing else, you've got no commute, like all you've got is like the need to sort of feed yourself and rest and maybe briefly exercise per day. Like, it's kind of insane to realize that with a full-time job, you still actually don't have that much time left in the day, even with everything else taken away. You're like, oh, this is bullshit. This is so much of my life. Like, at the moment, it doesn't matter because it's like, what else could I be doing? But it's actually made me very resentful.
We managed to make it about like 10 seconds. You're right, 45 seconds before we're back on your capitalist rant about full-time work.
Full-time work is bullshit. The system is broken.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Look, it's nice. I'm sure. I got a feeling it might not be the last time we somehow circle back to that. To go back to the book for a sec, and actually yourself. So you're a stand-up comedian now. I guess technically.
I'm in theory at the moment. In practice, usually in practice at the moment. In theory, I'm a stand-up comedian.
And you're from WA originally.
Yeah, I'm from Albany in WA. Lived in Perth for a while. Yeah.
Okay, that's like, so where'd you grow up? Was it like
Albany's on the southwest coast. It's where Tim Winton is from. A lot of his books are set there. Nice. I nearly picked Cloud Street as my book and I was like, I actually don't feel like rereading that right now. But that was a little bit of a seminal novel for me.
And it's
a great book.
Australians, you're all obsessed with Tim
Winton. We're all obsessed with Tim Winton. Yeah. He's all of our dad. I think it's been like a lot of like rubbishing of Cloud Street over the years, probably because so many people were forced to read it in high school English, but I think it's great. I think it holds up. And also, you know, it's set in Perth and it's set in a kind of time in Perth that was very personal to my mum and like so, and a lot of those places are really familiar to me, and yeah, I thought it was great. But yeah, lived in Perth for years, but from Albany originally.
This is a running joke seems to me to be about how much South African families and stuff seem to have there seems to be a strong strain, of South African people.
I don't know what it is. Yeah, there's so many of them. Mm. Maybe they liked it because it's racist. I don't know.
Perth's racist because they liked it and went there.
Perth's racist because of the sheer volume of South Africans. Though I don't know. I'm sure that there's plenty of not racist South Africans. Like, not hashtag not all South Africans, but. I think maybe a lot of the ones that left were like, I'm going to go somewhere that's more white. And they picked Perth because it's hot and boring.
Yeah. So there's no South African connection directly for you, but you just know of South Africans coming and colonizing the area.
Yeah, quite a lot of them. Yeah, don't know what it is, but yeah, definitely a bunch of them there. Not so much in Albany, though. Albany's like a little sort of kind of, it was a bit of a sort of, hippie or not hippie town. I don't know. It's just, it's coastal. It's a lot of sort of tree changes. It's a cute town.
Okay. All right. So that was a connection I was saying. What about in terms of the, you mentioned the feminist angle in uni when this book first hit you, was there an interest in like the whole post-apartheid thing as well? Or was that just like,
I kind of remember why I picked this up, but no. No, I just read a lot at that point. I just read a lot of books, and this was just one of them. But yeah.
So, and if we don't want to talk about this, we don't have to. But I do find the gendered, like women's body thing as well, super interesting. And this is me because I haven't read it, so I could be getting.
You should definitely read it. It's a very quick read.
Yeah. No, I think I will, especially anytime with that. it's a quick read. Just add it to my.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It seems like from what I read though that it doesn't, it kind of approaches it in a less direct, it's the idea of someone, like, how can I phrase that, it potentially sounding so horrible, but he's like, the affair that he has, it's not like there's a degree, like she's involved just as much as he is, so the issue there isn't as directly obviously a
That's something that definitely stuck out to me more when rereading it, which I found really interesting, is that, so basically there's like two major areas of like sexual assault in the book. There's it starts out with his affair with a student, but there's a scene where that is quite explicitly, I would say now, like a rape scene. Like there's and he pretty much, like, the, you know, the protagonist pretty much calls that out, that he sort of, I think he calls it like unwanted to the core. Like it's a kind of pretty disturbing scene. But it's sort of, I think at that point it sort of slips your notice a little bit on first read, because it is sort of contextualized within an otherwise sort of, and not an equal affair because it's a student and a teacher, but, you know, an otherwise sort of like a romantic situation. And then, you know, later on there's a much more sort of, you know, explicitly, like the text is much more explicit about the fact that there's, you know, a violent rape in the context of a home invasion. And, you know, you sort of, that tends to stick in the mind more. But then sort of rereading it as an adult, I was so much more disturbed by I was so much more disturbed than the first time I read it by the first sort of depiction of the student, the teacher and the situation there. I was much more sort of sickened by it. And it was interesting, when I was sort of Googling last night just to see if there'd been anything written about this book more recently, I found an essay by Gia Tolentino, I think, in the New York Times, revisiting this book in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein trial. It's a great essay. Talking about power and unequal relationships between older men and younger women, and exploitation and situations of you know, dubious consent or like questionable consent where there's power involved. And yeah, it's reading that as an adult, definitely. Oh, as an adult, I was technically an adult when I first read it. I would have been like,
yeah,
19.
First year uni. No.
Yeah. But yeah, rereading that now, I was like, oh, this is so much more sort of personal to me now. I've sort of, you know, definitely had more, I mean, you definitely experience some sus things as a, you know, female teenager, but you get so much more. You're such a smorgasbord in your 20s and 30s. Of just male nonsense.
You just get to the full range, yeah.
Yeah, not even necessarily like, you know, actual assault or actual situations of, you know, like danger or predation or whatever, but like just more like sort of coming to understand the sheer like weight that men's power has in society and how that sort of plays out in so many different ways. And it just, yeah, gave that sort of scene in that part of the book a lot more weight for me. Rereading it, I was like, oh, this is actually just as important in the text as the sort of explicit violence in the middle. There's a lot of implicit violence to this that I didn't really pick up on when I first read it.
Right. So, and again, this is me because I, look, because from what I read of it, it looks, and because I always find it interesting when they frame it like this, and especially when it's a dude writing about another dude who's then doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But people love reading about it. But it seems like the way the book frames it is almost like how that's not the powers change now from what maybe it used to be. So he suffers for this stuff more than.
Yeah, a little. There's actually, now that you mention it, there's a part of it that's really kind of prescient about cancel culture and about sus dudes railing against cancel culture. Cause like that is sort of his trajectory in the beginning. So the student sort of reports him, like the student's in the book, like her work starts to go downhill. She's obviously, you know, you can tell from her behavior that she's pretty disturbed by what's happened. I think she's sort of like dropping out or failing. And he gets reported, I think, by her parents to the university. He has to go before like a tribunal or a disciplinary panel or something. And he takes the opportunity to to speak in his own defense of just of using like really pompous intellectual language and really pretentious language and flowery metaphors and, you know, in a way that was clearly never going to help. But I think he's sort of his lack of remorse and his lack of understanding about the reality of what he did is then sort of something that he comes to terms with over the course of the book, but not on an intellectual level, on almost like a bodily level. Like from there, he's sort of like physically broken down by the end of the book. Like he's set on fire at one point. Like by the end of the book, he's older and his body's decaying and he's putting down dogs. And like, I think it's a much more interesting way to sort of look at his decline than to show his ideas changing.
Right.
He sort of becomes closer to the earth in a lot of ways by the end of it.
Oh, right. Okay. As in like nature and stuff.
Yeah, but like real nature, dead dogs. Not pretty trees, dead dogs.
Okay.
Yeah, look, it doesn't end on a nice note. It's not a nice book, but yeah. And I don't know, maybe that's today. I've had too much time alone with my own thoughts over the last year and a half, but yeah, maybe the stuff about like coming closer to the body and the sort of like the stripping away of intellectual pretensions and ideas and getting closer to the realities of the physical body again might be hitting a little bit harder because of COVID. I find like lockdowns can often be so physical. Like, you know, we've obviously gone through a lot of them in Melbourne now. We've had a chance to really get inside them and really experience them. You just sort of – there's such a focus on your body a lot of the time because, like, a lot of the only things that you have to do are, like, to feed yourself and to – like, the only chance to get outside you have is to, like, exercise. And so your whole day just becomes structured around just, like, the needs of your own body and kind of nothing else, which is really strange.
Uh-huh. So it's something, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, watching, like reading this story about someone becoming a horrible mud grub, I was like, yeah, me too. Not because I necessarily did anything bad, but me too, buddy. Oh, there's this quote, actually. I wrote down a quote from it that I really liked because I've been dealing with a fair bit of lockdown depression at the moment, as have we all.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm normal. Mm-hmm. And there's this passage at one point, he says, "His pleasure in living has been snuffed out, like a leaf on a stream, like a puffball on a breeze. He's begun to float towards his end. He sees it quite clearly and it fills him. The word will not go away with despair. The blood of life is leaving his body and despair is taking its place. Despair that's like a gas, odorless, tasteless, without nourishment. You breathe it in, your limbs relax, you cease to care, even at the moment when the steel touches your throat." I was like, oh, I'll feel that.
Okay.
Because all the nice things and all the ideas and the conversations and stuff are like stripped away and you just left with you and your mucky little grub body.
Guess that's an accurate. You've said grub body so many times, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay, like a few things. So, firstly, yeah, that is grim. So this is depressing. Were you? Do you like the depressing? Like, obviously, I can see right now. When you first read it, was it the same reason you kind of liked the fact that it was so? This is more depressing than I thought, actually.
The first time I found it very shocking and a little upsetting, and this time I found it not comforting exactly. But you know, sometimes with things that aren't nice,
does that tell
sometimes
about your growth as a person.
Yeah, it was horrible, and I liked that.
Yeah.
No, it's just, I don't know, maybe when I think when you're in a bad place, there's a comfort in feeling seen or feeling to have had an aspect of what you're feeling expressed by someone else, you know, the you know, that horrible we're all in this together thing. But like, you know, there is a comfort to recognition and to seeing that what you're going through is not just you.
Mm. Even when it's like a fictional thing, because you're like, this has happened, yeah. Even if this situation
is part of the human experience, yeah, clearly, because someone wrote it down. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So it's like it's almost just another version of listening to sad music when you're sad.
100%. Yeah. And I think there is a value in that to an extent. Yeah.
Okay. So just reading a whole book, depressing books when you're depressed. That's.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before, and I like it. I dig it. Yeah, I'm
I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm binging Ted Lasso as well. I'm not insane. Like,
yeah, well, exactly. You gotta have some sugar.
You gotta have both.
Yeah, you have some sweetness with the sour, with the bitter loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I was going to say with that, and this probably might tie into, because you do like stand-up comedy and the writing and stuff. What's the writing like in
this book?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite
sounds amazing.
Yeah, well it's interesting. In a lot of it it's very plain, quite stark. It sort of only goes into the more flowery language where it's sort of directly expressing the protagonist's point of view, and that again is sort of stripped away as the book goes on. It's really like the prose is really quite stark by the end of it, but it's a little more sort of flowery at the beginning where he's still hanging on to intellectual pretensions, and there's sort of a lot of references to sort of romantic poets and stuff in the beginning, and that's sort of again stripped away by the end
really?
Of it.
So I love that
the prose changes a little bit over the course of it, but yeah, no, it's quite plainly written. It's which I like.
Is that because the language side of things, because were you always writing? Did you like writing yourself? Did you
study? Yeah, I've always kind of written. Yeah, I did. I came to Melbourne in the first place to do a screenwriting course, and then kind of dribbled off, and didn't really do much with that, and stayed here. But yeah, I've always written. I did like a minor in creative writing at uni, and I do love prose. But yeah, I often like quite flowery prose, and this book is really quite plain and stark, but it works for the subject matter.
Have you read Lolita?
Yes. Yeah. This has aspects of Lolita, definitely in the sense of like having a really unlikable protagonist who doesn't fully understand the realities of his own sort of relationship to power and relationship to women and power. It's definitely, it's got some strong Lolita sort of echoes.
Hmm. I was thinking like, that's exactly what I was thinking. Plus Lolita's got the ultra flowery language as well. That's something.
Whereas like, yeah, that's kind of sustained throughout Lolita, and he never really sort of fully comes to. No. I mean, it's been a long time since I've read it, but I don't think he ever really fully comes to terms with what he's done on the level that the protagonist in Disgrace does.
Nah, he doesn't really learn.
he's still sort of Whereas there's definitely like an aspect of that to the way that Disgrace starts. Like the protagonist really sees himself as part of this grand romantic tradition. He's obsessed with Byron. There's a quote in there about something about like a woman's beauty does not belong to her alone. He's got these like very sort of iffy ideas about romance but those are definitely absolutely hit with a stick and destroyed by the end.
You keep going back to how fucking grim this is. I like it.
I cannot emphasize enough how grim this book is.
This is sounding more and more COVID appropriate.
With just like mounds of dead dogs. Like I'm done.
Like just the polar opposite of Save the Cat in screenwriting.
Mm-hmm,
just
mm-hmm.
Kill the dog. Just again and again.
It's fucking grim as.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think, you know, there's probably some legitimate critiques of this book to be had as well. Like I remember when I was first reading it, you know, it was the early 2000s. Like we hadn't really sort of had those conversations as a society yet about like identity politics, and a lot of conversations that happened in like literature and academia around, you know, who should or who can write certain things. And this is, you know, it's not a book that I think everyone would appreciate, because I think for a lot of people, quite legitimately, the idea of a, you know, middle class white man writing about colonialism and race and gendered violence, you know, that's going to be a little bit much for some people to get past, which is completely fair enough. But yeah, he is writing about, you know, he is setting this book in like immediately post-apartheid South Africa, because that's when he wrote it. So, you know, it'd be pretty crazy to talk about power and not grapple with colonialism and racism.
Yeah. And like, I mean, I want to push back on that just a slight bit, because like I'm all for everyone should be you, and like, you know, if you feel this way, that's right. But at the same time, I feel like that's not fair, because as long as you do it in the right way, everyone should be allowed to do everything. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah,
like,
totally. And I mean, you know, I think only a bunch of extremists were saying that like there should be an absolute prohibition on people, you know, on people writing certain things that aren't from their point of view, blah, blah, blah. I think it's more just that we had a very valid conversation about who should tell types of stories, or the lack of people telling their own stories. And like, that, you know, so no one's saying.
Those are two different things. That's why I'll push back on the first half of that, saying like, yeah, the issue isn't these people doing it. And even if I want to write a story about like anything, as long as I do the amount of right research where it's legit and I do engage with the community.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not saying okay. Wouldn't be able to write that. I'm just saying, yeah. I think if someone said to me, races are sensitive, because I'm, you know, white. Like if someone said to me, like, race and colonialism is a really sensitive topic for me, and I just something gets my back up about reading white men write about it, I would think that was completely fair enough. You know, no, I'm not going to force anyone at gunpoint to read this book. I just wanted to, you know, flag that as something that might not work for people about this. But
yeah I mean, like, but again, even the he's writing about it from the perspective of, like, it sounds like it's writing about it in the right
way.
He's
grappling, yeah, he's grappling with his part in it. And you can definitely tell that he's working out some stuff about himself through this character, like maybe trying to, like, get into some of the parts of his psyche and his understanding of the world and his culture that he's really deeply uncomfortable with.
Yeah, and, like, it's actually from his perspective of the impact of colonialism. So it's not him writing about it from – so he's not making any assumptions, essentially. It's giving the only argument – that's why I say what you said before.
I think you pulled it off, but I'm just saying that other people might disagree.
Well, I think you can take a position and say they're wrong to disagree. That's what I reckon.
Nah. No, but that's the beauty of literature. You know, there's a multitude of different perspectives on it. None of them are wrong per se.
No, that's what I mean, though. The only issue here would be which has been the issue traditionally, is that his is the only voice that's getting.
Yeah,
this is the only perspective getting seen. So I've got nothing against.
And look, at the time that this was written, that probably was much closer to the case. You know, this really was not that. Like, when did apartheid end? The mid 90s? I can't even remember.
That's as if that was that late. No way.
Early 1990s.
Early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So, you know, this, I'm not sure which year this was published. I know it won the Booker Prize. I think it was the Booker Prize, in 99. So
that's fresh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, this really wasn't, it was published in 99. So this really wasn't that long after all of that. So, you know, I'm sure there was an absolute lack of, you know, Black South African writers writing about their own history and their own culture. And, you know, so, yeah.
That's wild. There is
something that's worth sort of picking up on, I reckon.
Yeah, no, definitely the side of things where, like, and this is the whole story of culture, but this is why I was pushing back on the specific of being upset at anyone writing about it isn't the issue. The issue is other people not getting their say into it and getting that part of the culture.
Yeah, totally. Oh, but I mean, you know, it's not like no one has ever tried to tackle a subject that they're not massively well equipped to tackle and fucked it up horribly. And I just mean that I think it's like totally fair to like have a problem with that aspect of it and being like, why the fuck did you think you should tell this story?
Yeah, look, I think it's, yeah.
And it goes back to the theme of the book of, like, you know, understanding that civilization is a ridiculous intellectual construct. It doesn't really mean anything. And, yeah, the protagonist definitely grappling with, like, but there's quite explicit passages about, like, the limits of language and how language is, like, it can be, that it was something that he used, like, language and literature was something that he used to understand the world, and then he comes to realize that it was actually sort of keeping him at a distance from the reality of the world that he was living in.
So you're saying, as in, like, it was almost a barrier. Essentially, he was intellectualizing the world instead of living it.
Yeah, and he was understanding his place in the world not just through the through the lens of his own class. You know, he's a sort of an upper class white guy in immediate post-apartheid South Africa, but he was also understanding his place in the world through the lens of like romantic poetry and those sort of like historical and literary traditions. And yeah, then sort of there's a great passage where he says something about like how English is such a it's such an inappropriate or not useful language to express the reality of South Africa and of the yeah of the time.
Because
he goes from Cape Town at the beginning of the book to a more sort of rural area where there's less English spoken, and sort of understands more that like that he's been in this sort of like rarefied bubble that worships like Western culture, and that's actually not a huge part of the country that he's living in.
Oh, okay, all right. So it's a reflection of what the country actually is. So, but specifically English, not like.
Well, because there's lots of different languages spoken there, and he sort of ends up in a region that doesn't primarily speak English, that speaks local dialects and Afrikaans and yeah. I don't know if he's supposed to have been speaking English or Afrikaans in the novel, but you know, but he ends up in a region that doesn't speak either.
Okay, so then he's got to grapple with that side of things. Yeah, it's interesting. So you're saying like the very use of the language was both a form of colonial. Lism, I guess, the fact that it's
English. It's not like anyone was speaking English before the whiteys got there.
Yeah. But and then like, yeah, I don't know. I vary on
or this. Afrikaans. Afrikaans was just like a corrupted dialect of Dutch.
Yeah. Mm. Because like, yeah, I'm always swinging on this because it's like the idea that language is that important. Any individual language is that much of an impact on how you think. So I don't know.
Not so much the language or the dialect itself. It almost more talks about how like language itself, like the need to intellectualize concepts and put them into language, can itself be a means of keeping the world and the reality of the physical world at bay and at a distance. Like, and that's sort of, there's a really lovely metaphor through the novel of him starting out trying to write this, like, I think it's first maybe a novel and then an opera about Byron. And by the end of it, it's just music. It's just like notes that he's picking out on a broken banjo that he's found in the attic because he's found like he's found an aspect of this story because he's trying to write it about Byron and one of his lovers. And then by the end of it, he's completely shifted his focus and he's obsessed with this one of Byron's lovers who's grown old and she's sort of she doesn't really know what to do with herself and he finds himself identifying with her, not with Byron anymore. But he also finds that he can't find the words to express her story. He can only sort of plinky plonk it out in music.
That's really sweet. But also, yeah, what are you trying to express if you're trying to overthink it and overcook it rather than just like express the thing itself? And sometimes, yeah, language can get in the way of that or a certain, if you're trying to, especially snooty, like I'm going to do it in this way. And then it's like,
the only valuable language is like English and filtered through the lens of academic traditions and stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I can see it. So yes. And so really and to put it back to what I was saying, so COVID essentially has stripped us all back. To our bodies, yes. To our forgetting of language, to our basic nature.
Oh, God,
nature.
Yeah. I've literally, like, forgotten how to use words at times. you know, a lot of my work is, like, over email, and sometimes I'll open my mouth to try and talk to, like, my housemate or a delivery person, and I'll just be like, I can't.
Yeah, after a few days alone, you can sometimes start feeling like that. I live alone, so I just talk to myself constantly. That's the secret. Mate,
yeah, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you've got a pet around, you just constantly jibber-jabbering to them.
Yeah, except I've now found a fun problem is I'm talking to myself in public sometimes, which I've got to stop myself.
Yeah.
Like little expressions.
Masks are great for that, though.
Yeah.
I've found that, like, times I just want to have a little mutter to myself and I'm in the supermarket. I'm like, oh, I can. As long as I keep it quiet, I can just behind this mask and no one can tell.
Yeah, that's better. My one that I noticed where it stuck out for me the most was actually, this is in between lockdowns, you know, those tiny islands in between.
Oh, those brief little moments, yeah.
And I was at a cafe and I was on a laptop just to be not in the house and I just started talking and I was like, oh, fuck. I'm in public.
Oh,
people
no.
People looking at me and I'm like, ah. I'm on AirPods. You can't see them.
Yep. Yep. Oh, yep. Man. It's hard. We've all, we've definitely all gone a little cuckoo. I mean, not all of us have become anti-vaxxers, but we've all gone a little cuckoo.
Yeah. We've all found our own little expressions of it.
Yep. Yep. I'm thinking about joining a fight club after this.
It's the only way to feel alive.
I think so.
Once life gets back to normal, you're going to be like, fuck society.
I mean, honestly, reading this novel is a little bit like the intellectual equivalent of a fight club, so.
That is, that was my favorite quote I'm going to get from the show. okay, cool. We've kind of just focused on the more depressing aspects of the book, but I've actually very much enjoyed that, especially the idea.
I'll pick up on some of the less depressing aspects of it. The font is nice. That's it. There's nothing. It's a really depressing
that's
book. It.
Yeah. No, that's sometimes that's. I'm kind of want to read it now, though. To be honest, it's worked. It's worked in a weird roundabout way.
It's short, it's sharp, it's like a bracing punch in the face.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. I guess we'll probably leave it there, I think. On these two fantastic quotes.
If you've gotten this far, all I can say is Ted Lasso, binge the whole thing. I'm so sorry. I'm going through some stuff.
I can tell. We all are, so it's okay. All right. Awesome. Is there anywhere people should catch you on anything, I guess, before?
Vaccine center. I won't be there, but you should be. If I'm going to plug anything, I'm going to plug fucking vaccinations. Yeah. I want to see my family at Christmas.
Are you seeing the ads now for – I'm seeing a lot of performers now starting, like – comedians putting up
for Melbourne Fringe.
Yeah, and you're honey.
I had to hide under a blanket for a minute. I didn't know what to think. I still don't know what I feel about that. I'm like, I am so happy for people who have hope.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, like that's a hard one.
I mean, look, it might happen. It might happen. And I think it's a little, different to Fringe last year. I think people are probably going in with a much more realistic idea of the odds of it happening.
Yeah.
And great, good.
I'm looking at Perth for Fringe as well next year, January, Feb, and I'm like, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably happen. It's just, will they let us dirty plague state people in?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. And I'm not, but a lot can change. You know, all you need is the number's going to go down. I don't know. Yeah. Anyways, let's not turn this into a COVID podcast. This is about abuses of power in colonial, post-colonial South Africa.
Yeah.
No, thanks a lot. All right, well, we'll leave it there then.
Thank you for letting me get a lot of stuff off my chest.
No, it was great. That was I don't know if fun is the right word, but it was interesting. All right, awesome. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.